Session number 22354, Reel 5.
Terry Jefferson, Reel 5.
In the meantime, I told the taxi driver in my fractured French, he spoke no English at all, just why I was there and why I was going to the hospital. He had left me getting out of the taxi because I was still walking very slowly, and gone into the hospital, found a nursing sister, told her what I was looking for. She had gone to the private room where Madame Vermigen was lying, in a coma, incidentally, and her daughter Jacqueline, who had been sitting with her, came hurtling along the corridor, threw her arms around my neck, burst into tears and told me how ill her mother was. So I went to there and I sat with Madame Vermigen for several hours, speaking to her, although she woke up and went to sleep, and I never knew that she knew I was there. But before I left, I gave her, in her hand, my parachute regiment cap badge. I later learned that that was buried with her. Anyway, I came back home and kept in touch with Jacqueline over the next several months until she phoned one day, or rather, she didn't phone, her granddaughter phoned to say that Madame Vermigen was dead. So I then contacted this man, Tom Barrett, who had been back to the farm and met me. And we went across to the funeral. Airborne Forces donated a wreath, which I had made locally. It was a cushion of white flowers with a Pegasus on it. And I took that across. And Jacqueline said to me that her mother had said that when I die, that when I die, you must ask Terry to say a few words over my grave. Well, I didn't know enough French to be able to do that, so I did it in I wrote in English, a very short speech, if you like, and a French friend, a friend of the Vermigens, who spoke excellent English, stood by me at the cemetery, at the church, during the Mass, and as I read out this little message, sentence by sentence almost, he translated it to the French. Now the church was absolutely packed. There were enough flowers to keep the church going for the next 12 months, I should think, and there were several hundreds of people outside listening to this service, so these people were very well known. What I've omitted to say in the past is that in addition to writing to the British government and the War Office to try to get Madame Vermigen a medal, there were two medals issued. One was the King's Medal for service, and the other was the King's Medal for Courage, I think, which rewards the foreign nationals who had assisted the English during the war. Unfortunately, I'd left it too late for my application to be considered. And they said there was nothing that could be done. However, I continued to write to the French authorities and explain the whole situation, and as a result of this, Monsieur Vermigen was awarded posthumously the French Medal of the Resistance, which was presented to his wife in 1976, I think. Naturally, I went across for that ceremony as well. Was still not satisfied with the recognition received. So I continued to write to Airborne Forces and to the British Army. And I had a letter back from Sir John Mogg, who was then Chief of the General Staff, who said they'd take the matter up with the airborne forces people, because there was nothing that the army as such could do, and since most of these people looked after by the Vermichens were airborne anyway, that perhaps we could do something about it. But eventually, General Gale went across on one of the anniversaries, I think it was the 40th, and presented to Madame Vermichen an illuminated scroll telling very briefly the story of what she'd done, and a plaque showing Pegasus and the parachute regiment crest underneath, which she kept, obviously, for until her death, and is now in the possession of her granddaughter. Unfortunately, the scroll, which was shown, hung on the wall in her granddaughter's house, was ruined when they had a tank flood, a water tank flood, which caused a lot of damage to the house, and it almost obliterated this scroll, which was, I say, beautifully illuminated, and unfortunately done in English, not in French. Sorry, I'd missed that bit off. But when I went to Madame's funeral, there were a lot of the people there who knew me from these two previous visits, one for the presentation of the medal and one for the presentation of the scroll and the plaque. And from that time on, the number of friends I've made in France exceeds the number of friends I've got in England, I think. I just keep in touch with the Vermichens. I go across quite frequently, stay with Dominique, the granddaughter. I kept in touch, well, with Madame Vermichen until she died, with her daughter until she died. And I have been back to the monument to Monsieur Vermichen several times. In the church there, at Saint-Pierre-Jean-Quay, there are a number of graves, some of which have got names on, and the others are unknown, of martyrs, you know, morts pour France. One pair of them is two brothers. I think one was only about 18 and the other was even younger, who were shot by the Germans for, you know, either assisting or resisting at the same time. And I think that's really as much I can tell you about the Vermichens, except it's an ongoing story. I'm now in contact with the man who gave Monique Vermichen her first blood transplant. Of always the donor of her first blood transplant, who, quite by accident, became my host when I went across on the only time ever going across to France with the unit, the Old Comrades Association, when we were found out among the people who lived in Merville and Franceville and the villages round about, and this chap, Jean-Pierre Guillot, and I have become firm friends. And it seems that every time I go over there, I meet new people, new friends, and it's just like a pebble in a pond. It just goes out and out and out. This business of the John Golly in the book, you know, quite unexpected. It was something I didn't expect to happen. It was just done through the Old Comrades Association, the French version. Neil Barber with this book that he's writing and my story on the internet. And now you. It just goes on and on. Is that how? I suppose it would stop one day. I don't mind it, but I didn't seek it. Anyway, my army career.
Well, what about Palestine? Could we say something about that?
Yes.
About what happened to you there?
Not a great deal, actually. I mean, it's... we went to Palestine in October. We the battalion, that is the entire 6th Airborne Division, went to Palestine in October 1945. It was during the Troubles when they were having all this, the exodus from Europe into Palestine, and we were supposed to go there and intervene. There again, my battalion went first of all to a place, a village called El Mugar, which was a very primitive camp, and later on to Castina. And we took part in one or two minor operations, what they called cordon search. If, for instance, when an attack was made on the car park in Tel Aviv, and some men were shot, and some vehicles were destroyed, and it was thought that the people who did it had been tracked to a village, and we did what they called a cordon search. Now, the army were permitted to cordon the village off, nobody in, nobody out, but they weren't permitted to search. That had to be done by the Palestine police. Now, the Palestine police, as you possibly know, were composed mainly of about a third Jews, a third Arabs, and a third English. And they were the ones who actually did the searching, and they very seldom found anything, for one reason or another. Either they were in the wrong place, or any weapons or any people who'd been wounded were very well hidden. And it's not very often they actually had a result. But on one of these cordon searches, it was after the Irgendes Weilerme, one of the terrorist groups, or liberation groups, depending whose side you're on, had attacked Castina airfield, and they destroyed a number of our Halifax aircraft, or Halifax or Stirling, I'm not sure. But the aircraft that we were using at that time for dropping had been blown up and destroyed. And I believe that some of the guards there had been either killed or wounded. Anyway, quite a massive operation took place, and several villages were surrounded, and the 9th Battalion was taken to one particular place. And we did our job of circling around, you know, stopping anybody going, anybody coming out, except that on the first evening, or the second evening, the first evening, I think it was, we were there, a lady came to us, and or to the sentries, and said, "Do you have a doctor? My child is very ill." Well, naturally, being the medics, we were there with them in case of any trouble. And our doctor, whose name was Marquis, McPhee Marquis, Robert McPhee Marquis, said, "All right, if it's all right, if I can get permission, I'll come in." Anyway, we had permission to go, and once again, young Terry was dragged along. Now, it was a bit dodgy because we could quite easily have been walking into a trap. We could have been taken in and held as hostages, or it could have been a genuine emergency. And I must admit that I wasn't too happy about it, but that was my job and there I went. Anyway, it turned out that this child was quite ill, and being the eldest of a very large family, having some very young brothers and sisters, I recognised thrush when I saw it, and this child actually was had an affection of thrush, which is an infection of the throat, and it's noticeable because it has a sort of furry growth on the inside of the back of the throat, and it can grow and it can cause asphyxiation. It can also cause convulsions. So I said to Dr. Marquis, "I've seen this before, so I think that's thrush." He said, "By God, I think you're right. What can we do?" And we had some sulfonamide, and we also had penicillin, which was only just about coming into use at that particular time. So I said, "We'll try the penicillin." So he gave this child, he dusted the throat, I think, with penicillin powder, and then he gave the mother some penicillin tablets, I think 3, and told her to dose the child every 6 hours. Well, we never did learn whether the child recovered or died or what. We never got any thanks for it. And when we withdrew the following day, the child simply appeared to, well, was still alive and looking a bit better. So we hope that we did a good job.
Was this a Jewish family?
Oh, yes, yeah. That's why we were so concerned, because we thought we might be, you know, sticking our heads into the noose, as it were. However, it turned out all right. There was an interesting period when, once again, the 9th Battalion went to Tel Aviv, and we set up a first aid post in a big office, big modern office block called Citrus House, where I had a medical inspection room with Dr. Marcus and a couple of other orderlies, and there were various other orderly rooms and things in other parts of the building. Nothing particularly exciting happened where we were there, except that we were patrolling, the battalion was patrolling, but during that time there was no real trouble, and we were even allowed to go out subsequently into Tel Aviv and, you know, go to cafes and restaurants. So things weren't too bad at that particular time. And really, nothing much of interest happened to me then until I was demobbed in the end of March. I got the last thing to happen to me in the 9th Battalion, which was a little unique, I suppose, that we had to parade outside the orderly room before we left the actual unit to receive our travel documents and our service books, which contains a recommendation from the commanding officer. Now, mine was quite glowing, as it so happened, but I was called off the parade to go before the CO, and I didn't know why. He said, "We've asked you before, and I'm asking you again, will you sign on for at least a further 6 months?" And the reason for that was that Bobby Marquis had been asked by the Deputy Director of Medical Services for the 6th Airborne Division to liaise with him and some others about the medical services in parachute, in airborne divisions after the war. And he and I had put in a lot of hours working out a scheme which we thought was based on the wartime scheme, where each parachute battalion had its own medical section working under the umbrella of the brigade field ambulance, and it had worked very well during the war. Whereas in peacetime and in ordinary infantry battalions, the bandsmen were usually the medics, the medical orderlies, and they then would have a field ambulance of REMC people to evacuate their casualties back to. And each infantry battalion would probably have only a doctor and a couple of trained orderlies, not a full group. Anyway, I have a copy of the findings of this inquiry when it was finally published late in 1945, and a lot of what we'd suggested was found to be too expensive, because they couldn't afford to keep medics, you know, highly trained and expensive soldiers attached to infantry battalions who themselves were doing nothing really effectively. So we got to the system where it reverted almost to the peacetime method, except that something they did learn from us was the equipment that was necessary for a parachute field ambulance. Different stretchers, these Neil Robertson stretchers, which are like made of wicker and fold round the body. They use them for getting people out of tanks, and a light airborne stretcher and a light airborne trolley. This question of using hampers to drop the equipment rather than containers is all part of the suggestions that were made by this small group of which I was a member. Anyway, I was asked to sign on because Bobby Marquis had to do another 6 months. He wanted me to stay with him, and I said, no, I've been in the army for 6.5 years. I've had enough. I want to go home. And I came home, and it was one of the biggest mistakes of my life, because I should have stayed on. I knew that I'd get at least another stripe. I was a corporal at the time. That was quite certain. And there was the possibility of getting warrant rank as well. But quite honestly, I'd had enough.
So how do you feel now about having served with the 9th Battalion of the Parachute Regiment in the Second World War?
It was one of the most interesting periods of my life. I have to say this, very often we are asked, people are asked, what was the most important day of your life? And I have to say, it was the 1st of September 1939, when I gave up my civilian job, which was then working in a brewery, I was advancing quite rapidly through the ranks. I went there as a labourer. And by the time I left, just 15 months later, I was able to operate all the machines in my section and was full-time operator on a new, very high-tech labelling machine, which doesn't seem a lot, except that this brewery employed about 300 or 400 people, and I was regarded as promotion material, if you like. I was interested actually in learning how to make beer, in becoming, eventually, a brewer, which is quite a good job. Now, the war stopped that, and by the time the war was over, my objectives had changed. I didn't want to go back to work in a brewery, and I became a carpenter. I thought, well, Pompey's been blitzed. There's a job for life for a carpenter. It didn't work out that way at all. It was a mistake. I should have stayed in the army, and if I'd stayed in the army, I know that I'd have finished up better off than I did. Mind you, I wouldn't have met my wife, I wouldn't have had my two lovely children. Things would have been so different.
Did the war change your attitude towards life?
Yes, to a certain degree it did. I've always been an acceptor. I've never really pushed myself forward. Things that have happened to me have happened to me, very seldom due to my own... I can't say quite what I'm trying to say. I didn't look for promotion. I didn't look to do these odd things that I have done. They just happened. But they were interesting, and my life was interesting. I was very proud to be a parachutist. I was very proud to be in the airborne divisions. I was very proud of what my units and comrades had done. And I'm still proud to have been involved in it. I don't think I would have been quite so proud as I am, this word keeps on coming up, had I waited, not joined the Territorial Army, not become a medic, not transferred to the Paras, and being called up and probably being put into a rifle battalion, you know, round about the end of 1940. I don't know. It's hard to say. But I don't regret what I did. I don't regret what I did or what occurred to me down during 1939 to 45. I regret what I did in 1946 by coming out of the army. In the meantime, I've got a hole in my leg. I've got varicose veins. I've got constant discomfort, not pain, constant discomfort. I've got a war disability pension, a motability car, and I've managed to work all my life. I'm not a cripple, I'm not bedbound, and I know of so many, 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 many people who are far worse off than I am.